Connecting the city and surrounding villages. You've found Cambridge 105.
I quite like baked apples in the winter.
There's no fancy pants stuff in there. It's just proper English pork and it's lovely.
It's just a real sort of hubbub of stuff happening.
Do you remember I bought some chickens?
That's right.
That's when we started to sell eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's where it really started.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you become a butcher?
It's fun. I was at a friend's house once and I was helping her dad cut up a bit of venison. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I just knew I enjoyed it. Now I can do it properly.
We don't stint on the smoked salmon.
Well,
I don't.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, and thanks once again to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. I'm Matt Bentman and we are here to bring you an hour of Cambridge food and drink. In the studio today, well, an empty chair where Ruth Reyes used to sit. She's busy preparing for her move to Barcelona tomorrow. Alan Alder's here though. You're not moving away, are you, Alan?
Well, sorely tempted actually, Matt, but probably not too much good food around. And thanks to the listeners who sent Ruth their best wishes too. They were very well received. On the programme today, we've news from Food Park, which reopened this week after its short winter break. We hear about Radmore Farm Shop's move round the corner. Alice Archer will be talking about Spanish wines. Tina Roche of Cambridge Cookery School and Cafe will be advising on kitchen gadgets. And we hear about a vegan bakery in Cambridge.
Yep, and we've quite a few interesting food snippets along the way too. Some tweets, some food in the news, that sort of thing. And later on, Emer O'Hanlon from Emmanuel College will be joining us with the University Food and Drink News.
But to begin, Heidi White set up Food Park as a means of bringing good quality street food to the people of Cambridge. It has grown and grown. It's now on three sites, and I met Charlie Mackay-Rietoff, Food Park supervisor, on Thursday, and asked her for a summary of what goes on and about what the future holds.
Charlie, back from the winter break. Who's appearing at Food Park at the moment?
So today we're at Cambridge Science Park, and we have Tin Kitchen, Rosti Strass, Gorilla Kitchen, Buffalo Joe's and Steak and Honour.
What sort of food is all of that?
Tin Kitchen does ciabattas, really, really great filled ciabattas. She does great veggie options as well as meat. We have Bao from Gorilla Kitchen. Again, they do meat, veggie options, really delicious, and he also does some side dishes as well. You think he's got ribs on at the moment, which are absolutely delicious. Rosti Strass is Rosti, so potato kind of cakes, and which is great. All of his menu is gluten-free. Steak and Honour, obviously, they're doing the burgers. And Buffalo Joe's is fried chicken and wings, which are incredible. Incredible wings they do.
Right, so some good food.
Great food.
And does it attract many people?
Yeah, we get a really good turnout. Actually, Science Park is particularly popular, and I feel like, especially on Twitter at the moment, lots of people are very excited that we're back. That's the kind of impression that we're getting, so it's brilliant.
Because you're not in a very visible place. You wouldn't come across you accidentally in the Science Park.
No, but luckily we've got signage, so if you do come into the Science Park from Milton Road, just follow the signs and basically you'll find us.
And where else are you?
So on a Wednesday we're at Charles Babbage Road, which is on the West Cambridge site, which is just off Madeley Road. There from 12 till 2.
So do you get good numbers there?
Yes, yeah, it's a lot of the research, I think, for the university.
Right.
So we get some really good numbers there.
So do you hear any interesting conversations then?
Mostly it's about food. So what are we eating today? Do you want to share a wandering yak with a steak? And so that's what most of the conversations
are about. So it's not about sort of nanotechnology?
No, not that I've heard.
And then on Friday?
We're at the station. At the moment, it's on a road called Mill Park, which is just off Station Road.
Right, because you've had to move around a bit there, haven't you, to fit in with the developments?
That's right. And we're really lucky because we have a really good relationship with the developers, and they're really visible to us. They eat at Food Park every week, and they're really, really supportive. So we have moved around, not that far from where we've been, but we're definitely on the plans for the development, which is really, really great. And hopefully where we are now, we will stay for a few weeks at the very least.
Right, so you're not under threat then? You're not going to be sort of... Your space isn't going to be built on or anything?
From what we understand, no. We've been led to believe that there will always be a space for Food Park in that area, which is absolutely fantastic, I think.
Well, it caters for a lot of needs, doesn't it? There isn't a lot else around that.
I imagine there'll be lots of chains going in, you know, as the development continues.
Yes, as people like Pret have already opened up, haven't they? But I mean, what you're offering is really rather more exciting, isn't it?
Absolutely. It really is. Yeah. You know, it's that, you know, good posh fast food, basically. And I think it's a lot more exciting than getting a sandwich from Pret.
You're on trend. And what about on the science park? Because there's building happening here as well. Are you?
Yeah, we've moved once. We were in a different location, but we've actually been here for probably about 7 months now. So, yeah, I think this is where we're going to be for the foreseeable future.
Right. And have you got any new traders coming on?
We have. We've got two new members of Food Park that have come along kind of over the Christmas period. We have Rural Coffee Project, and they sell coffee, hot drinks, like tea, hot chocolate, and they also sell sweet bites, like cakes, brownies, things. And they actually do their coffee from a Land Rover Defender. It looks fantastic. The coffee's fantastic. The people who run the business, Hannah and Andy, are fantastic as well. Really, really lovely people. And we're so thrilled to have them on board. The traders particularly, because they can get coffee now. So they were at West Cambridge yesterday, and you know, it's great for us because we can go and have a hot drink before we set up. So that's brilliant. And the other new trader is Kora Kora, which is a Sri Lankan street food business. Their food, again, is so lucky to have them on board.
So what sort of things do they do then?
So they do the most amazing onion bhajis. I mean, like, they're like the size of your hand. They're incredible. And they do a really, really delicious cashew nut curry, which sounds maybe a bit odd, but it's absolutely delicious and really like crunchy and savoury and just spicy, and it's fabulous. So
I think I'm going to have to try this.
Yeah, they're great. And they've got a really colourful setup as well, so it's really brings something to Food Park. So yeah, we're so happy to have them board, and again, a lovely couple who run it. So they've both been really good assets to us.
Right, do people sort of apply to join you then?
Yes.
And then what, there's a, you have to go and taste what they,
yeah, so that application we made through Heidi, and then she has a process, and yes, obviously she tastes every food. You know, if the food's going to be here, she will taste it and see if it's suitable. And also, you know, we're not interested in having competition and clashes. You know, there might be someone who is doing, I don't know, you know, burgers, but you know, Steak and Honour here, they've been here since day one at Food Park. We're not going to be chasing someone else to do burgers. You know, if you apply, you know, we're looking for stuff that we don't have.
Right, so a bit of diversity.
More diversity, yeah, and more variety for the customer, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what we would want. So, yeah.
Yeah, great. Well, it seems to be going very well. And it's certainly been going for quite a long time now.
Yes, June 2014 it started. Heidi started it. I came on board relatively new on board. I started Steak and Honour with my husband Leo, and left that business in the summer and actually joined Food Park working for Heidi. So I haven't gone too far, and it's just worked out perfectly, really. But Heidi puts a lot of work into it. It's one of those businesses that looks so easy, but there's someone, you know, kind of scurrying away behind the scenes to make it look that easy.
Right. Well,
I think it's testament, really.
Right, well, one day we'll do a little feature about the scurrying that goes on behind the scenes.
Yes.
I think that'd be quite interesting. And are you branching out at all this year, doing anything different?
So we've got a tap takeover at the Blue Moon Pub, which is coming up. First one is on the 9th of March, and we hope there to be more of those. We'll be announcing our summer night market dates very soon, which we did last year, which were really successful.
There's a lot of people go.
We get a really good crowd of people. Yeah. It's absolutely fantastic atmosphere, live music, there's bars, fantastic food, and it's so family friendly. We get loads of families there. It's just a really great event. So we are continuing with those this year.
And Steak and Honour seems to be doing extremely well.
Yes, the first restaurant opened recently, which has been going really well. And it's nice that they're still at Food Park as well. That's something they're not going to stop doing.
Yeah, sticking to the roots, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's people like it. They like coming. You know, it was just a win-win for both of us, really. So I think Food Park and Steak and Honour, it's a great combo. Yeah.
Right. Thanks very much, Charlie. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Charlie from Food Park. We'll find out more about the night markets in a future episode of Flavour.
Every fortnight, Bums on Seats brings debate and discussion on the latest movie releases. From blockbusters to art house, our panel of reviewers are passionate about film.
There's one thing in common, and that's that I think they're all absolutely brilliant.
Well, you can see the ending by watching the trailer, because I was surprised they show it in the trailer.
You wouldn't know it was the ending if you hadn't just said it.
And we'll agree to disagree.
No, I don't agree.
Hosted by Toby Miller.
We take the latest cinema releases for a dance and a drink and report back on which ones have turned our eye and captured our heart, and which ones will be blanking in the street if we happen to pass them.
Join the team. Alternate Saturdays at 12 noon on Community Radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
Let's look at a couple of items about current foods now. We did a feature late last year with Sarah Lavelle of Quadril Publishing, and she talked about a forthcoming book by Catherine Phipps called Citrus. Here's a little of what she said.
Yes, Citrus is the third book from Catherine Phipps, who is a phenomenally talented cookery and recipe writer. When she started looking at citrus and various different types, it became clear that it's such an extraordinary ingredient, one that we're generally familiar with, but it's, you know, you put some over raw fish and it makes it edible. It's like, you know, ceviche. It's cooks it, and one squeeze in a sauce or a can totally change the taste of it, or in salad dressings. And so citrus looks at the, I mean, it does look at the fruits we're most familiar with, but also more obscure ones, things like yuzu, bergamot, and maybe the sort of fruits that we're all familiar with at Christmas, like satsumas and tangerines, but how you use them in cooking. So it's absolutely packed with recipes. We've got over 170 recipes in here. All her recipes use every bit of citrus. She even deep fries citrus slices as a snack, which is quite interesting. Right. But the zest particularly, she does, it's almost like a natural sweet. She very finely shredded zest, she boils it up and then cooks it in a sugar syrup and then mixes it with a little bit of citric acid, and what you get is the equivalent of those really sour fizzy sweets. I mean, really kind of mouth numbingly sour. They're absolutely brilliant. And when we did the photo shoot and she brought a whole box of this candied citrus zest along, I just could not stop eating it. I was just addicted, and I must have been eating it for across about an hour, and then I discovered I couldn't actually talk anymore because my mouth had gone so numb. It was fantastic. And yeah, it covers everything. There's a beautiful salad. There's a coconut, lime and lemongrass chicken salad that my colleagues at work were raving about when someone made it. And there's a gorgeous pavlova, which is bergamot and Turkish delight pavlova. It's just beautiful.
Well, citrus is now in the bookshops. It arrived during the week, and you'll already know that if you follow Flavour on Twitter at Flavour105. And what a good book it is. Catherine Phipps is a recipe developer and develops them, well, not only for her own books, but also for some very well-known and high-selling cookbooks ostensibly developed by other chefs. There's a wide variety of recipes, and it's well worth a look. I made a very good fish dish with fried lime-soaked plantain from one of its recipes. Delicious.
Very delicious. Now, I've always loved the buzz around the opening of a new shop. You know, all the prep in the final few weeks, even that new shop smell. And this is because I was a child when my parents opened up their motorcycle shop. My dad's, he's a mad biker, see? Anyway, it was the same when I went to the opening of the Urban Larder in Mill Road in 2009, and it was the same again when I went to the opening of Hot Numbers in 2011. So it was really great to be invited along by Ben Aveling and his family earlier this week to the new Radmore Farm shop on Victoria Avenue. Today is their official opening day. They've been open since 10 this morning, and here is Ben to tell you more about his new place.
It's Tuesday night. It's all hands on deck. You're here with your wife, Vicky, and your two sons, as we can hear on the radio.
You can hear Leo. He's here keeping an eye on us, aren't you? He's accessing all the new product on the bottom shelves, so he's had to come in the interview with me. It has its moments, but the children like coming along with us, and that's all part of, not in a commercial way, but it's part of our brand. It's part of what we always are very proud of. We've always done what we can.
Yes.
And our business has fits in with the children, and they enjoy it. but it's also very important ethos, because a massive chunk of our customers are just like us, and they like to think they're supporting a business that has a family, and do you know what, the boys absolutely love it. It makes our life a bit different, but we have a lot more, we have some very good staff, which is very lucky for us. That means we can dip in and out when we need to. As you can hear, Leah's having a very good time.
Well, come in, don't be hesitant, everything's for sale.
The main thing people will notice straight away is that it's all on one floor.
Yeah.
We've also expanded our meat fridges, so we've got no doors, better lighting.
Those lovely big front windows as well, it gives you so much more presence, doesn't it?
It does. Well, we had them remade. We were very lucky, we had worked very closely with the landlords of the building. So it was a complete ripped out, gutted shell. They liked us as a company, and we were approached because the pub next door is I think it's changing hands now, so hence our move. And as it turns out, it's looking very good. So we worked hand in hand with the landlord, and he helped us. For example, they've put a lot of effort in making it all as a brand new shell with new wooden frame windows. It's quite a nice front, and we've had bespoke shelving fitted into it for us, so we can try and maximise the space. But because if you can remember, in our current shop, it's quite a long reach to the front for a cabbage. Whereas we've actually had this design as an L shape, so you can stand sort of almost in the window and shop.
I just want to be alone.
And in some cases, you want to browse and decide for yourself without asking. So the label should hopefully cut out some middlemen for shoppers for you, so you can look at the label. Some of the rearing standards will be on there, or if it's a pedigree breed, for example. Because do you know what? Some people, and I completely understand, some people like anonymity when they shop. They don't really want to talk. And some days you had a really bad day. You know, I just want to go and buy my meat and vegetables and go home. And making that shop easier for everybody is what we're about. But we're here if you want to discuss what the product is as well. That's always been our way, because you definitely get what you want.
You got any blancmange? Yeah, I got two of their LPs.
But as well as that, we've gone for real bespoke, proper quality-made furniture. We've made our own counter. New till systems, so we can monitor our stocks even better than before, so we hopefully never run out of anything.
There's no labels on these tins. Well, we don't know that, do we? They might be on the inside.
You want to say something? Say, Say, Dad. Yeah, more products than ever before, more tasters. We've also even expanded the door for pushchair mothers and wheelchair access. We've kept the exposed brickwork where we can in the shop, so to keep it very Cambridge Victorian. Our counter and things has been made with reclaimed wood on the front, reclaimed trays for the vegetables. I've got some Hot Numbers coffee coming this week, so I've bought a selection of all of their coffees, because we've got a better way to display it now than we ever have done before. So we're going to have hopefully chilled drinks. They've been available as such, but not that you really notice. So everything's just a bit more visible, easier, more customer friendly in every way, really. Now I'm all over the shop. We wanted everybody to realise that we're here to stay, and we're big players on the farm shop scene. And the last year we worked very hard into trying to push it on as a brand. And in that sense, we've got brand new logos, which people have already started to notice, you know, here and there. We've even got reusable bags you could be able to purchase. And I think having a brand that stands out, it helps the customers trust you. When they come into this shop now, I think they'll be more trusting of you. They'll think, yeah, they're trying to do things right. I'm excited to see what our customers think.
It's showtime.
So we're all looking forward to the big Saturday opening.
Yeah.
It'll be grand. Won't it, Leah?
Yes. You'll be here, won't you, little man? It's going to be good. We've got tasters to give out. We've got things to give away. We've got new products. We're all going to be here. It'll be a casual day, so don't expect, you know, egg and spoon races and things.
Yeah.
And you know, different products in. The seasons will change. The vegetables will change again. And it'll be really interesting. So keep going. Keep coming.
Good stuff.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, Leo. Thank you very much, Hello. Ben.
Thank you very much.
And Leah.
And Leah.
See you Saturday.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
Good boy. Well done, Leah.
And that was Ben Aveling of the Radmore Farm Shop. There's plenty of buzz about their new place on Twitter, and you can find them on Victoria Avenue, next to Mitchum's Corner, just a few doors down from their previous site, in fact. And they also cater for online ordering via their website, radmorefarmshop.co.uk.
This is a pretty good time of year for food. There's plenty of citrus fruits about, which is why Catherine Phipps' book has been published now. But it's also the time for forced rhubarb, lovely slender pink shoots that grow in the dark. Nazima Pafan from the Cambridge Food Collective gave us a few ideas for it a while ago.
It's a great thing to use both in savoury and sweet dishes, great accompaniment to game meat such as duck. If you were to make a compote with it, if it was me, I would probably spice it with some star anise and other winter type of spices and then serve it alongside some duck breast, maybe with a red wine reduction. In terms of sweet, obviously, preserving it is a good idea, and both curd or preserves, it'll be a really good way to keep that pink colour. We also like poaching it. Now, one of the things about cooking with forced rhubarb is that when you cook it, sometimes it will lose its colour a bit. And so a good way to do it is either to bake it or to poach it in a sous vide type equipment. So if you've got some vacuum bags or some bags and then poach it in water, you don't need a sous vide machine really. You could put it in a slow cooker, but if you can put it inside a bag and a sealed bag with and get the air out and then cook it low and slow with the syrup inside, it will retain that bright pink colour. And that's something we did at a supper club a while back, where we did some mi feuille with a rhubarb and a cardamom cream. We actually had cooked the rhubarb in that way so that it remained a very bright pink.
And did it retain its shape, or is that
yeah, so by doing it that way, it will retain, because otherwise obviously it can get mushy.
Yes.
So you have to be very careful. And so a great way, if you want to keep that nice shape, is to poach it till it's just right. And then if you wanted to put it in a tart, for example, then lay them gently onto the pastry base and bake it. But I think cooking it in a pouch sous vide or in a slow cooker, in a water bath, essentially, is a great way to keep the colour.
Of course, not everybody has such a thing, but
but you can do it without that, as long as you can just keep it simmering, for example. But as long as you've got a bag that you can put it in any food-grade bag.
And you can cook rhubarb without actually adding any liquid to it, can't you?
Yes, so it will break down quite easily, and so it makes for a great compote. And one of the things, apart from the usual cinnamon and orange juice, which are great flavours to go with it, is cardamom goes very nicely. And we've done a compote with cardamom and sugar for rhubarb, which we served with a jasmine rice panna cotta, where we cooked the rice in milk and then used that milk, discarded the rice, and used the milk to make a panna cotta. So it had a very nice, delicate flavour to go with the sort of sour but slightly warm cardamom flavour of the compote. Nigella Lawson has a great one that I've also done as well, which is to put it instead of a lemon curd tart, to make a rhubarb curd tart, and that's delicious. I think the sort of tartness of the rhubarb with this very sweet meringue, but light meringue, is really nice, and it's a lovely flavour.
But it is important, isn't it, to retain the tartness, because without it, it's losing one of its essential characteristics.
Yeah, I think that's
really
right. I think it's a great flavour, and you definitely want that to be there.
Yeah, some lovely ideas there from Nazima Pathan for rhubarb. So have you come across any others recently, Alan?
Well, yes, there was another book that Sarah Lavelle recommended called Scandinavian Comfort Food by Trina Hahnemann, which had some fantastic suggestions. And on one delicious double-page spread, there are four rhubarb recipes. Two of them are methods of preserving. There's sweet rhubarb, which is with ginger and vanilla, and the other is sour rhubarb, a mix of rhubarb and lemon with bay leaves. And you leave them for at least 3 weeks in a preserving jar before eating. And also there's roast chicken with rhubarb and tarragon. Just great ideas.
Yeah, well, if anyone listening has any good rhubarb ideas as well, do let us know.
Yeah, they'll be gratefully received, I must say. But I must mention also the outstanding book by Nikki Segnit called The Flavour Thesaurus, which I know we've mentioned it before. It has rhubarb with things like black pudding, juniper, oily fish, or even cucumber. Here's the section about cucumber. She says, I used to love dipping raw rhubarb sticks in sugar and biting off sections that always threatened to be face-tighteningly sour. The secret was to overdo the sugar, which is surely what rhubarb's celery-like natural scoop shape encourages you to do. The effect was like a marginally healthier version of the sour fish and fizzy laces you find in sweet shops, the mouth-watering citric shock at once tempered and intensified by the intense crunchy sweetness. Until I read Paula Wolfert, I'd never thought of dipping rhubarb in salt, which a friend of hers reported people doing in Turkey. Further investigations yielded an Iranian recipe for thinly sliced cucumber and rhubarb, tossed and left to stand for a while in salt, and then mixed with rocket, lemon juice and a little mint, which Wolfert suggests as an accompaniment to poached salmon.
Mmm, as a funny.
Yeah.
Listen to Cambridge 105 on Radio Player at cambridge105.fm. There's also free apps available for Google, Apple, Kindle Fire and Windows devices, making listening on the go through your smartphone or tablet easy. Stream powered by LoHo for all your internet service and telephony needs.
On now to our regular kitchen gadget spot with Tina Roche of the Cambridge Cookery School and Cafe. Today, Tina tells us about an old favourite.
I think one of the absolute best tools in the kitchen is also one of the least expensive when it comes to actual electrical appliances, and that's a good old-fashioned electric whisk. I think we all know them. They tend to be white and very unglamorously coloured. The buttons might be a sort of untrendy light blue or light green, but they are just wonderful. They work every time, and they work for years, and they're probably less than £20. We have loads of them, and we have been offered lots more sort of attractive or trendy brands, if you like, but nothing beats, excuse the pun, the classic one. It's just wonderful. It comes with two sets of whisks. One set is for whisking, obviously, and balloon whisks, and one are sort of small dough hooks. And if you're working with very wet dough that we often do for our cinnamon buns and things, it's just fantastic. If you have a dough that's just a little bit too wet to easily be kneaded, then your dough, small dough hooks on these are the answer, and you don't need anything bigger that stands on your worktop. Or for whisking egg whites and things, it is just so wonderfully quick. So 10 seconds later, you have the perfect foamy egg white. I love them. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's grand.
So every time I surprise myself with how passionate I feel. Every time I say it, I must think, poor woman, she needs to get out more.
Many thanks to Tina Roche of the Cambridge Cookery School and Cafe on Hills Road.
Did Tina say anything about the cafe when you spoke with her?
Oh, yeah. Everything is going so well. Far better than they could have expected. So much so that they've had to take on extra staff to deal with all the demand. And that's just now, at this cold time of year. So imagine what it's going to be like when the weather really warms up.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
We had a feature last time on the Cambridge Food Collective and the fact that it's going to be delivering 5 days a week soon. Its Twitter handle is at CamFoodHub. Rather confusingly, Duncan Catchpole of COFCO's new Cambridge venture is also called a food hub. News about it is on the front page of the current edition of Cambridge Independent. Duncan was on Flavour talking about it last November. Here's a snippet.
What it's going to be is a large building, basically, where a load of local food producers and local small food businesses all come together under one roof with the objective of really advancing the food culture around Cambridge to make it more sustainable, more environmentally friendly.
Right, OK, but what are they going to do in this large building?
Well, the central feature of the food hub is going to be this rather fantastic food store, which is just filled with an abundant supply of the very best produce that is available in our local area. But there will also be areas for food storage and handling so that food can be distributed around the city from there, and also commercial kitchen facilities so that small businesses can come in, chefs will be able to select what they want from this wonderful food store and prepare it right there sort of in the same building, and hopefully come up with a whole new range of foods and really exciting brands of foods that can be, again, distributed all over the city.
Right, it's a fantastically ambitious project. So local producers will be able to place their food there so people can come in. It will act as a retail space as well as a distribution space.
Oh, yes. This will very much be a place that members of the public can come and visit. There'll be cafe, restaurant-type facilities, probably more on a pop-up kind of arrangement. It's not going to be a fancy, high-end retail environment. It's all going to be about the food itself. Come into the store, meet the producers, meet the people that are selling it.
But if it's going to be a big premises, is that not a difficulty? Because rents in Cambridge are very high, aren't they?
The very reason for wanting to set up this sustainable food hub is that small food businesses find it so hard to become established in Cambridge due to the high price of commercial property.
Do you think you'll find suitable premises in the city itself? Do they exist at a reasonable enough price?
It's going to be difficult. Our ideal place to look would actually be somewhere just on the outskirts of Cambridge. The idea being that that is the interface where rural food producing area meets urban food consuming area. But I think the business model is solid. It's based upon a number of already established businesses who are already turning over a decent amount of money. So it's not as though this is something that's starting sort of from nothing.
It's a fantastic idea, and it's gaining ground with 9 companies expressing interest and 13,000 raised in crowdfunding so far. But don't forget, you heard about it first on Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. And if you want to be involved, contact Duncan via cambridgesustainablefood.org.
Now, there's a popular vegan bakery in Cambridge, and Emer O'Hanlon has been talking with owner Lena Joseph. She asked her about the rising popularity of vegan eating.
Yeah, definitely. So, well, currently we're in the midst of a big vegan movement, and it just means that with the increase of consumers becoming vegan, there is more demand. So I think lots of people are now expecting in most restaurants or almost everywhere to have a vegan option, like you have a gluten-free option. But, you know, gluten-free option has taken a while. who's like, oh my god, I'm gluten free, I can't eat anything, I can go anywhere. But now you have that, and I think people are now expecting that with vegan food. And it's been great. We have been trading for around a year, more or less. January was our birthday. It's been crazy. Busy, good. Yeah. So we have, we supply lots of many, like, high street eateries and coffee shops and retailers, and there is a growing need for it, so it's great.
One of the ingredients that I know you use is the tiger nut.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about the tiger nut?
They grow in Valencia, and because I lived there for a long period of time, that's why I know about it. But in Valencia, you mainly do horchata with it. So I don't know if you know horchata. So horchata is like tiger nut milk. And it's something that you usually have during the summer. It's very seasonal. But then I went back to Spain a few times trying to find the horchata and all this, because I thought, oh, I want to bring it to the UK and see how it would work here. And then I met one of the suppliers, one of the farmers, and he was like, oh, we have tiger nut flour. And I'm like, oh, nice. So lots of experimenting with it also. Yeah, not very easy. Not easy at all. But I think now we managed to I think get it right. But I mainly use it for kind of gluten-free range. So I will add, a few spoons now and there to try, and it kind of complements the texture, and the flavour is kind of a nutty flavour. So it works very nicely.
And that was Emer O'Hanlon speaking with Lena Joseph of Gourmet Vegan. And Emer herself is here with us in the studio. So what did you think of those cakes then, Emer?
They're fantastic. They're light, they're airy, they're moist when they have to be, and they just look great.
Superb.
You can buy your cakes from a wide range of places in Cambridge, such as the Farmer's Outlet Shop in Lensfield Road, Radmore Farm Shop in Victoria Avenue, Daily Bread in Kilmaine Close off King's Hedges Road, Espresso Library in East Road, and Stir in Chesterton Road.
Lots of places. On a bit of a sidetrack, there's a petition doing the rounds at the moment on 38 Degrees about Cambridge Market, put out by one of the councillors in Market Ward, one from a minority party. And I must say, I've rarely seen anything so misleading. It manages to paint a truly negative picture of the market. It talks of dozens of empty stalls, dirty and torn awnings, rotting wooden boards lying around in heaps. But the truth is that stall lettings are well over 90%, and if you do see an empty stall, it's because the trader hasn't been able to turn up, maybe because of illness or an appointment, or just bad weather means that they would earn very little. And as for the other negative comments, well, go along and see for yourself. I can see no torn awnings and no rotting wooden boards either. I also wonder if the councillor spends too much time in expensive food markets, supermarkets, I should say. On the market in Cambridge, everything isn't wrapped up in plastic. It's real. And yet, the purpose of the petition is worthwhile. It asks the city council to invest more in the market. But its effect may be to give people an entirely wrong impression of it and put them off exploring it. And by the way, Cambridge Market has just been named one of Britain's best markets, so perhaps that puts the comments from the councillor into context.
It's John Gannon here. Join me for the 60 scene every Sunday, 11 to 1, for the best in 60 sound, including my guitar twanger's corner, the What's On Spot, and the 60s Top 10 chart, right here on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
Now, let's take a visit to food journalist Andrew Webb's historical bookshelf.
This month on the historical bookshelf, we're looking at The Englishman's Food by J.C. Drummond and Anne Wilbraham. I've picked this book not so much for what's between the pages, although that is quite fascinating, but also for the story of what happened to the authors. We'll come to that in a minute, but first let's look at the book itself. It's got a lovely front cover here with a sort of woodcut of a Tudor gentleman and then a little sort of woodcut of a chap in a bowler hat. And the reason for that is that it's a history of 5 centuries of English diet. And J.C. Drummond was a professor of biochemistry at University of London. He was a scientific advisor for the Ministry of Food and did a lot of work on rationing during the war and was a great proponent of nutrition and its effects on health and those sorts of things, and was foremost a biochemist of his day. And he was also director of research at Boots, the chemist. And Anna Wilbraham was his secretary in PA, actually. And eventually he'd left his first wife and married her. We'll come on to their story in a minute, but let's just first take a look at the book. And it's interesting to see a book these days that has things, chapter 8, rickets. There's not a lot of books. Chapter 7, though, is scurvy. So he's applying his scientific knowledge to looking at the food of this of England has changed our bodies and affected our diets and our health and that sort of stuff. Then he moves on to sort of things like industry and agriculture and what we grow and how that's changed over 5 centuries. And then he breaks it down into sort of history and class and what rich people eat, what poor people eat, what they eat in prisons. And so it's a complete census in a way of 5 centuries, but in a really, really interesting way. And so it's broken out into like little chunks. So we've got here, you know, fats, sugars, vegetables and fruits, dietary pattern, how we change from eating in the main meal of the day, in the middle of the day, to later and later in the evening. And there's a whole thing on here on vitamin A deficiency in teeth, cod liver oil, rickets. It's a real kind of look at things from a scientific point of view and how that has changed. And so I really like it. I mean, if you're into science and food, as I think many people in Cambridge probably are, then it's well worth a look. So what actually happened to Jack and his wife Anne? Well, after writing this book and just doing research for nutrition during the war and all that sort of stuff, they decided to take a holiday to Provence and drive there with their 10-year-old daughter Elizabeth. And on hot August night, they camp by the side of the road and near to a peasant's house, and they were tragically both murdered, as was their daughter. And it became known as the Domenici affair, because the accused was a chap called Gustav Domenici, who lived a few yards away from where they decided to camp, which is by the side of a busy road, which in itself is quite unusual. And so the Domenici affair, as it became known, kind of scandalised the press. And there's a sort of analogy with the shootings we had in the French Alps a few years ago, where Saeed Al-Hilli and his wife and mother-in-law and 2 children were attacked, as well as that cyclist who was shot dead. It was that kind of thing. You know, how could this well-established wartime sort of scientist and, you know, public figure, and his wife and 10-year-old daughter be brutally murdered by these French peasants. And so the people have looked into this, and there's now a new sort of set of theories that have come out that, in fact, that Jack was a spy and was having meetings with various people as he was drifting down through France. And some people have looked into it and think that is actually what happened, and it was either a botched job or execution or some kind of contract killing or something like that. And we just don't really know. And obviously there's no official kind of MOD opinion on any of this. But it's telling that Domenici was initially sentenced to death for the murders. Just 5 years later, had its sentence commuted to life imprisonment, and by the 1960s was released. So, and pardoned by Charles de Gaulle. So I think it's interesting that this is one of the few books we've had on the historical bookshelf where the author's life has, and tragic demise has eclipsed essentially their life's work. So a bit of a sort of a sad tale this month on the historical bookshelf, but do go and check out the book if you can pick up a copy of it, because if you're interested in the diet of what people ate across five centuries, depending on their social class, as well as science and history and all that sort of stuff, it is a really, really good read. It's not a dry textbook. It's a sort of census and a kind of well thought out look at how we've got to where we are. So that's The Englishman's Food by J.C. Drummond and Anne Wilbraham. That's all for the Historical Bookshelf this month. I'll see you next time. Until then, thanks for listening.
Andrew Webb there with a book from his Historical Bookshelf, and you can follow Andrew on Twitter at foodjournalist. And we've got some really good things on Olio. Olio is the free food sharing app. And they're all, I think, from Great Shelford. Things like, well, there's a lot of things, but 3 pots of sliced cucumber, 3 kilograms of quinoa salad, whose eat-by date is March. There's a walnut and apple salad, tuna mayo, feta black olive wholemeal baguettes, and lots of other things as well. And they're all available free from Great Shelford.
Good stuff. A time now for our regular monthly visit to the Cambridge Wine Merchants on Cherry Hinton Road. This time, wine specialist Alice Archer is going to concentrate entirely on Spain.
Yeah, it's always been there on the wine map. Some of the earliest settled European vines were in Spain. And they actually have the largest vineyard area of any country in the world. But they are actually only the 3rd largest producer in the world. So they're behind Italy and France in production terms. That's because central Spain, incredibly hot, very arid. They can't have vines bunched up together, lots of long rows like you can have in Italy in slightly cooler areas, because the vines will get too hot if there are too many clustered together. So they've got a very sparse vineyard area. They've also got fantastically old bush vines. However, they might have become a bit unpopular because they had these old vines that weren't yielding as much fruit. And now there's a great resurgence of winemakers from all over the world settling in Spain and using this fantastic old vine fruit that they've got ready waiting for them. Not just do what the land's going to give you, but trying to make lighter wines from hotter areas. And there's a Scottish chap who's got vineyards in Calatayud and is making amazing wines south of La Rioja at the top of Spain.
From everything that we've learned so far, it sounds almost like an oxymoron that you could make a lighter wine from a hotter region.
It is an oxymoron, precisely, but it's definitely a trend that's happening the world over. There's, you know, high alcohols, big, heavy wines aren't so much in fashion. So people are trying to make lighter, leaner wines, picking earlier. And it's not easy, but you can get some fascinating expressions if you don't leave your grapes on the vines for too long, don't let them go all jammy. And it takes good quality and skill. There's a fantastic quality fruit waiting to be used in such a way. Then they're never going to be light wines, but lighter than traditionally. Anyway, so as I say, we've covered Sherry before, we've covered Rioja, and those probably are the big names from Spain.
Yeah.
However, Spain actually has 60 different DOs, Denominación de Origen, and Rioja is just one of those. Cava is just one of those. There's also fantastic variety, north, south, east, west. Just above Portugal, you've got Galicia making fantastic, light, zesty white wines from the Albariño grape variety.
Because for anyone who's not familiar with Spain, to describe the climate, you get all of the climates in Spain.
Yes, so Galicia is this lush, green, pleasant land, and it's also has something like 6 times the rainfall of another area of Spain. So no, it really is remarkable the variety you can get. If you look at right down the south, Andalusia, it really is difficult to make a standard dry wine there. That's why sherry exists, because it's very difficult to make a normal dry wine in that heat and sparse terroir. So yeah, it goes from these zesty, light Albarino through to inky, dark black, rich, heady, over 15% Monastrell. And you go from world-famous Rioja to more obscure regions like Calatayud or Chacolí. It really is remarkable. So anyway, we at Cambridge Wine have teamed up with Quirico Tapas and plan in 2017 to give you a full gastronomical and finest tour of Spain. We're talking 5 tastings, really going in-depth into both the wines of that region and what foods traditionally come from there. So the cheeses that they make there, the hamons they make there, the fish that they catch from nearby, the styles of their cuisine. I think it's promising to be really interesting. We're starting fairly classic in February. It's our first one. We are doing the wines of Andalusia and the foods of Andalusia. So this is all about sherry. Lots of lovely sherry. I do have the menu somewhere, but it features things like salt cod. I think there's a goat stew somewhere in there. The next one is going to be celebrating the wines and the food from Aragon, just south of Rioja and just west of Catalonia. It's actually where Estefania, who runs Quirico Tapas, comes from originally, so she's very passionate about this area. Aragon actually has the same patron saint as us, St George. So that's going to be in April, and it'll be a nice St George's Day feast of Spanish food and Spanish wine. So from around there, you've got lots of lovely garnacha. Garnacha is the Spanish word for Grenache. Nice and fruity, good juicy wines. Also a little bit of Tempranillo as well, which is the grape variety you tend to get in Rioja. Our third one will be in June, and we're going to travel all the way down the east coast from Catalonia, right up in the north, down to Valencia. That's where Cava comes from. You get some lovely light, fresh whites right on the French border, and then down to these deep, dark, inky Monastrells from Valencia. So that's June. There'll be some rice, some game, some seafood. Valencia, of course, that's the region for paella. Next, we're going to have a bit of a break over the summer. We'll be back in September with the wines and food from La Rioja, Spain's most famous wine region. There'll be some remarkable reds, delicious whites, and of course, fantastic food, and food all from that area again by Estefania from Quirico Tapas. Finally, we'll be looking in November to the north of Spain, Galicia, that more lush land that we were talking about. So there'll probably be a few more vegetables, certainly a lot more fish. I'm hoping for some octopus, definitely, famous Galician dish. The dates are all on both Cambridge Wine website and on Quirico Tapas website. They're £32.50 for 5 tapa and 5 wines, all matched with them. And I'll do a little bit of talk about the wines from that area, and Estefania will explain the foods that she's cooked. So I'm pretty excited about this. It's a big travel around Spain over the year.
Yeah, a whole year of Spanish
food. A whole year of Spanish food and wine, yeah. We're going to do one other special thing with Quirico Tapas this year. So aside from the Gastronomical Tour of Spain series, Quirico Tapas have been experimenting matching tapas with other types of drinks, not just with wines or sherries, but instead with cocktails. So on the 18th of March, we're going to do something completely unique and special, and we're going to have tapas and cocktail matching. Why not?
Whose idea was this?
That was Estefania's, but I am keen to go along with it. I'm Alice Archer, here at Cambridge Wine Merchants on Cherrington Road, and you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Well, that sounds fantastic. A grand Spanish tour of gastronomic feasting of the wine merchants this year.
Yes, and getting away from the more typical Spanish dishes, all on Cherry Hinton Road.
OK, we've got a few tweets that have come in. Lots of Valentine's goodies at the Gog Magog farm shop. Burwash Manor is doing both pre-made and bespoke Valentine's hampers. And the Cambridge Cheese Company in All Saints Passage apparently has some absolutely excellent Hayford cheddar now in stock and ready to eat. On to the Cambridge Food and Drink News now, and here's Ema with the University Food and Drink News.
The Cambridge University Whisky Appreciation Society will be hosting an international tasting on February the 10th, 8 p.m. in the Tower Room of Selwyn College. The tickets will be £14 for members, £18 for non-members. The Wine Tasting Society continues its full programme with weekly wine tastings. Wednesday, February the 8th, we'll see a tasting of Greek wines with Anton Leonidakis in Peterhouse Upper Hall. While on Wednesday, February 15th, there will be a Gunning for Grenache with Alice Archer of the Cambridge Wine Merchants in the Wordsworth Room at St John's. Both will start at 9 p.m. Tickets go on sale at 6 p.m, 4 days before the event, which means that Greek wines will go on sale this evening, while Gunning for Grenache will go on sale next Saturday. Their first two events of term have already sold out, so if you're interested, make sure to keep an eye on the website. Murray Edwards is currently recruiting general workers or team leaders for its garden party on Sunday, June the 18th. Workers will get one break with immediate queue jump privileges, so as well as being paid £35 for the day, you also get as much free food as you can eat from some pretty tasty stalls. Finally, following their successful intercultural mixer last term, the University Arab Soc will be hosting an intercultural food and drink event on Sunday, February 19th. Further details will be published near the time through their mailing list and on their Facebook page.
On to the city news now, beginning with three lots of congratulations. First to Hot Numbers in Gwydir Street for being judged by the Daily Telegraph to be one of the best 30 cafes in the country. And second and third to the Hole in the Wall in Little Wilbraham and the Pint Shop in Peace Hill for being judged by the Times to be two of the top 100 restaurants in the country. Well done, and we're not surprised, are we?
No, certainly not. And on to the jobs now. The Senate Bistro in St Mary's Passage off King's Parade is seeking a chef with responsibilities such as menu design. So pop in and see them if you're interested. Fitzbillies have several part-time and full-time jobs, all needing experience. So they're looking for waiters, baristas and a catering assistant. So simply pop your CV into the Trumpington Street branch.
The Punchard in Quayside is after a chef de partie and a commis chef. And Novi in Regent Street require a front-of-house supervisor. Pay is up to £19,500 a year. Email your CV to msaunders@novicambridge.co.uk.
On to events now. I was contacted yesterday by Cyrus and Abigail of My Persian Kitchen. They run pop-up Persian food events. They've been going great guns since we featured them last June, and you can find that episode in our podcast section on the 105 website, by the way. And they are hosting a pop-up today at Limoncello's on Mill Road. It kicks off at 6:30 tonight, and if you'd like to go, you just book a place via their website, and that is mypersiankitchen.co.uk, and follow the link. And don't worry if you can't make that, because they have another pop-up coming up on Saturday the 25th of February at The Architect on Castle Hill. Same booking rules apply.
Tomorrow at Trumpington Village Hall in Trumpington Road, it's Seedy Sunday, a chance to pick up flower and vegetable seeds cheaply and to get some really unusual varieties too. Admission is £2 for adults, free for children, and it's on from 1:30 till 4 p.m.
On the 8th of February at the Queen's Head in Newton, Reggae Kitchen, and on the 15th, Steak and Honour.
Oh, right. Well, I think I might go to that.
On the 10th of February from 6:30, there is a night market in the Market Square. Now, this is linked to the Illuminate Festival and includes some food stalls, such as gourmet vegan, vegetarian street food, Greek, African, Brazilian, Portuguese and Spanish. There'll be barbecues, burgers, cheese tasting plates, coffees and cakes. There'll also be poetry, photography, jewellery, all sorts of other stalls. Details are on the Illuminate 2017 website.
On the 11th of February at Novi in Regent Street, there's a K Rico tapas Valentine's pop-up with canapés on arrival and four tapas-style dishes. It's 7 for 7.30 and costs £35 and 11 pence. And bookings are at Eventbrite.
Also on the 11th of February, at Burwash Manor in Barton, they have Juicy Swine, Tin Kitchen, Churros Bar, Rural Coffee Project, Flock Cafe, and that's from 6.30 to 11pm.
And at Novi on the 14th of February, there's a Valentine's Day sharing board, meat or vegetarian, plus a cocktail, £30 from 6pm on your own private table.
And on the 18th of February, at Hot Numbers in Trumpington Street, okay, not Gwydir Street, it's the first of Indus Kitchen's World Curry Nights. This is curries from India. It's on the 18th of March, it will be Thailand. On the 15th of April, Morocco, followed by Brazil, and finally the Caribbean.
And back to the Illuminate Festival. On the 15th of February, there's an Illuminate wine tasting event, an evening of discovery of Greek wines with a fun experiment to prove whether lighting conditions influence our perception of wine.
And now that Ray's, the chicken place in Wheeler Street, owned by Pizza Express, has gone, we learn that its place is to be taken by Honest Burgers of Brixton. Well, you rather like them.
They're good. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. It's a bit hard of Steak and Honour to have such a well-known competition set up so close to them, so soon after they've opened. But thanks to Emma Goldsmith and Katie Underwood for alerting us to that. And if you've had any food news, do send it to us. The email and Twitter details are coming up.
And that's all we have time for today. If you missed bits or just want to hear the whole thing all over again, we are repeated at 7am tomorrow and podcast from early next week.
And remember, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm, or follow us on Twitter at flavour105. And of course, we're not the only ones on Twitter. You can follow Cambridge 105 Radio at Cambridge 105 as well.
But until the 18th of February, from all of us here, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.